The next case we have on the docket today is United States versus Commisso. Parties ready? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Josh Grubaugh, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Gene Fidel, we represent the appellant in this matter. And Chief Judge Erdman, I respectfully request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's granted.
The Sexual Assault Review Board brings stakeholders together to ensure that victims receive beneficial services and to mitigate the number of future sexual assaults in the military. The SARB is but one example of where leaders are taking a comprehensive approach to combat sexual assault. These efforts should be applauded. Problematically, though, without the proper safeguards, these efforts can tarnish the prosecution of those charged with sexual assault. Here, in appellant's case, the SARB, United States Army Hawaii, had SARB members that were briefed of the facts of potential court-martials and sit on court-martials in substantial numbers. In appellant's case, the defense counsel attempted to remedy any potential conflicts of the panel by asking voir dire questions designed to ferret out these conflicts. However, three panel members provided inaccurate responses to his voir dire questions, and they frustrated his attempt to find the potential bias here. Now, the military judge abused his discretion when he denied the defense's post-trial motion for a mistrial, and when the military judge misapplied the applicable law. And that law is the Mack-McDonoghue test and the two-part test, which essentially asks, first, was a panel member dishonest in responding to material voir dire question? And second, had they provided an honest answer, would a valid challenge for cause have lain?
Counselor, is there any distinction to be drawn between a dishonest answer and an inaccurate or incorrect answer in terms of how we should approach this issue?
No, Your Honor, and that was the point I was going to get at, Your Honor, and that's how the military judge abused his discretion and misapplied the test. He misapplied Al-Baj, and this court said in Al-Baj quite clearly that it does not matter the subjective intent of the panel member. It doesn't matter if they knew at the time they provided an inaccurate answer. It doesn't matter if they found out later or realized later they'd provide an inaccurate answer, and it doesn't matter if they reasonably should have realized they provided an inaccurate answer. The duty of candor to the court is the same. And these panel members failed in that duty of candor to the court, and the military judge failed or failed in applying the correct standard. And so the reason that we can say that they provided inaccurate responses to your questions, there's three questions in particular. And the most salient question, to quote from the Civilian Defense Council, he said, has anyone heard about the facts of this case whatsoever? The answer to that question clearly was yes for three panel members, and yet they said no, and yet during the trial, they talked about how they'd heard of the facts of the case before and did not inform any of the parties of the court-martial of that fact. Instead, they decided to tell the SARB afterwards and fix.
Well, did they talk about the facts, or did they just talk about the fact that it involved somebody outside the Army?
Your Honor, so it's correct that you're correct on the premise of your question that they didn't remember the facts, but they did talk about.
Were they briefed on the facts?
And so just to refocus on the question that was asked by the defense, have you heard of the facts? Or whether or not you remember the facts, have you heard of these facts?
Were they briefed on the facts in the SARB? Is there any evidence or record one way or the other?
Yes, Your Honor. They were briefed on the facts of the SARB.
Okay.
The evidence in the record from that is the slides that were presented in the post-trial 39A session, the motion, the SARBs that were briefed on every side, at every SARB meeting. And if you look at those slides, you can see it's about 8 to 9 sentences. It's all from the victim's perspective. As the panel member says, Colonel Forsythe said during the post-trial 39A session, you know, these are facts that are the truth of which is assumed. There's no way to challenge these facts. And there's only one sentence which for some reason talks about appellant's take on the case, and it puts his take, his version of events in quotation marks, again suggesting that it's less truthful. So this is something that was presented to the panel members multiple times, up to 10 times, and yes, they've heard about the facts of the case, so that was an inaccurate response. This isn't the only body of question that they provided an inaccurate response to. There's two others, which where the Civilian Defense Council appears to be trying to find out if these panel members are on a board or an organization like the SARB. He essentially asked, are you a member of a group of the military that deals with issues of sexual assault in the military? The answer, no, and clearly the SAR does do that. And he also asked, have you otherwise been involved in the sexual assault response system? And as the post-trial 39A session makes clear, they are involved in the sexual assault response system, and Appendix F of AR 600-20 actually defines one of the responsibilities of the SAR members to oversee the sexual assault response.
Do we need to find prejudice here?
Your Honor?
If we are inclined to go your way.
Yes, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, we framed this issue as a structural error, and perhaps
I thought you did.
Yeah, and perhaps that was the wrong framing, because there is prejudice. The prejudice is the fact that there's implied bias, and that's how, in rereading and preparing for this argument and looking at McDonough, that's how the Supreme Court analyzed McDonough, and that's how it announced their two-part test. And overruling the Court of Appeals, which had vacated the findings and sentence in McDonough, they said only substantial, only errors that materially prejudice the substantial rights of an accused are reversible. And the reason it's not reversible here is because there's this two-part test, and it's not met in the two-part test. And I think that's consistent with this Court's holdings in implied bias cases, where essentially that finding of implied bias is a finding of prejudice to the system, a prejudice to the appearance of the system. And so if
a finding of implied bias is structural, I am not at all sure we've held that.
But, Your Honor, just trying to clarify that, it's not that it's structural, it's that it's a finding of prejudice. It's a finding. When we find the implied bias, this Court has never, in the cases that either the party cited or that either party appears to have found, has not ever looked at the underlying facts and tried to determine what would a non-biased member have found. What this Court appears to do is to say that there's a, I wouldn't say attack on the system, but there's this problem with the system. The public would lose faith with the military justice system if it knew members sat on this type of case. And because of that problem of perception, that problem of losing faith in the system, we will vacate the findings and sentence. So that's the test that we ask. If the two-part test and Mac McDonough is met, this Court should vacate the findings and sentence, as it did in Al-Baj, as it does in all implied bias cases.
So just to be clear, you're no longer arguing structural error. You're saying there's inherent prejudice once there's a finding of the implied bias.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not structural, but it'll always be there.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, yeah, I mean, basically you're arguing that in implied bias, the error is to the damage of the overall system as opposed to individual prejudice or actual bias.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. The difference with the implied bias and looking at the perception of the system and the way that the esteem that the system is held in and the perception of whether it's a fundamentally fair system, that's what the prejudice is, too. And it seems to be consistent with this Court's case law and what was done in Al-Baj and what we'd ask that it do here. And briefly turning to the second part of the McDonough test and how the military judge erred in applying the law, is he did not consider the totality of the circumstances when finding that a valid challenge for cause would not have been laid. Some of the circumstances that the military judge did not consider, it appears in his analysis, he only looked at whether or not the panel members remembered the facts of the case. He was not, or didn't analyze the fact that they were even exposed to the facts of the case up to 10 times while sitting in the SARB. As the SARB, as shown by the regulation and as explained by the members, it's they're putting on a hat and being a victim advocate, the people who are sitting on the SARB. They're ensuring the victim gets these services. They're ensuring they're not challenging the victim's allegations. And if you look at the way those allegations were presented, the truth of them were assumed. And the truth of the allegations must be assumed in the SARB for it to meet its administrative function, to provide. It's a sexual assault review board. It's not an alleged sexual assault review board. They use the term victim throughout. It's not alleged victim that's used throughout. So that's different when then these same members are asked to put on their hat as panel members and presume the innocence of the accused. And so when looking at that system, and we're also looking at the fact that 30% of appellant's panel was made up of these same members, that was also something the military judge failed to take into consideration in the totality of the circumstances. And lastly, and most importantly.
So what should we make of that fact? You've got three panel members. If it's just those three panel members, they wouldn't determine whether it was guilt or innocence by themselves. So what should we make of that fact?
Well, Your Honor, so the fact that it's not a voting block that in of itself would determine guilt and innocence, it's still We don't know how the panel members voted. We don't know how close the vote was. We don't open the box of the deliberations and determine that. And so as the Supreme Court said in Williams, and as this court has said numerous times in other cases like Peters, even if there's one member that causes the implied bias, that's sufficient. Just the fact that there's three members just shows that it's even more biased. And
who was the president of the panel?
Colonel Ackerman, Your Honor, which was one of the members from the SARB. And so, in a way, I would cite to Wiesen, a decision from this court to talk about multiple members, but in Wiesen, of course, it can rise the voting block, which could have determined the guilt or innocence of the accused. But most importantly, and this fact was brought up multiple times during the hearing, but not discussed by the military judge, was that we had multiple members, in particular Colonel Forsythe, who from the military, who said the system was unfair, who said this existing system was unfair, and who decided during the court-martial to fix it for future and prospective courts-martials by going to the SARB and saying, don't do this anymore because it creates this specter of essentially implied bias. And the terminologies that Colonel Forsythe used and the quotes that he used to talk about, he didn't want anyone to be able to doubt the integrity of the system. And if you look at Peters expands the scope of what the implied bias test means to talk about not just a hypothetical member of the public, but also talk about what members of the military think about the system, and also to think about what an accused thinks of the victim. And so we have testimony from military members who are saying that this system, as it stood, was unfair. And so for those reasons...
But we have testimony from those same military members who said that exposure to that information didn't bias them in any manner.
Well, correct, Your Honor. So they determined for themselves that they were not actually biased. So the issue, though, that they did not address was the implied bias for this court-martial and the perception of the system. So the fact that they made this own determination for themselves that they weren't biased has no determination on whether a member of the public on the outside would think it's not biased. But again, the quotes that Colonel Forsythe uses to talk about why he fixes for future SARBs, he said things to the effect of, I'm worried how people perceive the system. I want the system to be above reproach. These are
He did,
Your Honor. He did. He was worried about the taint that would be on the system, and he was worried how people would perceive the system.
Was he concerned that at one point he said it was concerned that he wasn't objective? I mean, he later said he was objective, but at one point wasn't he concerned?
He expressed concerns, Your Honor, about the possibility to have influenced, unconscious influence as well. He talked about the fact that, you know, if there's certain facts that he heard and he hear those facts that could prejudice him for future courts martial, he said it didn't affect him in particular in this one, but he said, you know, if the facts are particularly bad, that would have an effect on me. So he spoke to implied bias, Your Honor. And I think that part is clear. And so we ask that this court find the military judge abuses discretion applying the law, and that we ask that this court vacate the findings and sentence and remand the case to the judge advocate.
Captain Grupa, is the most concerning part of the appearance is that they did not disclose that they had been on the SARB, or does it look worse because later on they realized that this might be a case that they were exposed to and did not disclose that? Or is it a combination, in your view? Is just being on the SAR and not disclosing it, is that the most concerning part of this appearance?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's the most concerning part for the appearance. In reviewing the case law, I didn't see anything that suggested the failure to disclose could then be considered as part of the implied bias. Practically speaking, I think it is a concern. It is curious why they didn't do so, and it could be a factor in these circumstances. But nonetheless, even absent that factor, I think the most troubling factors are the fact that there's this specter of indoctrination in a way where they are presented 10 times in a position where they're supposed to assume the truth of the allegations, the victim's perspective or the appellant's perspective is put in quotes. There's no need to put his statement in there. It doesn't serve any purpose of the SARB to put accused statements in there. It's a confusion of the legal role with the SARB role. And then to say to these same members, go sit on the court-martial and judge his guilt or innocence. I think that those factors are by far the most troubling, but to the extent that is a factor, Your Honor, it definitely is troubling.
As well. Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just going to follow up. And your issue with the military judge's finding is that he misapplied the law, or his findings of fact are clearly erroneous, or both?
What is it? Your Honor, with the So with his findings of fact, there's only one fact that we found was clearly erroneous, or argued was clearly erroneous, and that was the fact where he said that Colonel Forsythe did not know of this issue during voir dire, and I don't think that's supported anywhere in the record. I don't think we can say one way or the other. But our main concern is the application of the law. If you look at his Chief Judge, I say over time.
You can respond to that question, and I have one more.
Yes, Your Honor. So the problem with his finding in the application of the implied bias test is there's four paragraphs in his findings of fact and conclusions of law that deal with it. Two of those paragraphs are just a repetition of the case law, sort of incantations of the test. It seems to be only one sentence that addresses a finding of implied bias. It just deals with the knowledge issue, whether they actually remembered everything, and he ignored all the other circumstances. So we argue that no deference is due the military judge finding of implied bias because he incorrectly or inadequately applied all the circumstances and ignored many inconvenient facts.
I think the Chief Judge had a question.
In your earlier presentation, you were talking about the questions that were asked the panel members on voir dire, and you mentioned whether anyone had heard about the facts of the case whatsoever. And I may have missed it, but it seems to me that you didn't ask about the question, had they otherwise been involved in the sexual assault response system? Is that because that is of lesser importance in your analysis, or how
should you
deal with
it? I believe I mentioned it,
and maybe I just missed it.
And no, Your Honor, I believe I believe those are the three key questions. The two that relate to the potential SARB, that being one of them, being part of the sexual assault response system, is definitely key. I just think these are the three most salient ones that I think are inarguable. Essentially, I think there's a few others that are closer call, and we're not even presenting those, the issue of knowledge and whatnot. But I think these three questions are just inarguable.
Okay, you'll have further time on rebuttal. We'll now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Tara O'Brien Goble, and along with Major Michael Cordy, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding that the panel members answered all material questions honestly, and even assuming an incorrect answer, more precise answers would not have formed a valid basis for challenge.
Out after the trial is over?
Your Honor, when you're finding this out after the trial is over, you look at the totality of the circumstances as it relates to all of the answers that were given during the Article 39A session.
So when he said that the members were honest, you think that was an accurate finding? That finding is accurate and supported by the record?
Your Honor, the finding that the panel members were honest, I do believe was accurate and supported by the record. It's important to look at the Supreme Court's decision in McDonough in analyzing how you determine whether an answer was honest.
Well, were these officers involved in the sexual assault response system?
Your Honor, in one way or another, every soldier is involved in the sexual assault response system. However, as it relates to the answer to that question, I think it's important to look at exactly how that question was framed.
Well, it was framed, have they otherwise been involved in the sexual assault response system? They're
yes.
On the sexual assault response board. They meet once a month to review all of the sexual assault allegations at that installation for the purpose of bringing them up to date. They're not Sergeant Snuffy out there somewhere who is just aware of the general regulations.
Certainly, the sexual assault response board is undoubtedly a part of the overall sexual assault response system, and that's why it's important to look at the way that the question was framed And overall, the question seemed broad at the outset, but it was actually rather vague because the defense counsel limited the question by adding words such as as a sexual assault response coordinator. So it essentially called for people actually actively involved, such
they
as
they were actively involved. How can you deny that they were?
Your Honor, as commanders, they attended the SARB, but
as
they were
the
not...
As commanders, they attended the SARB because they had to do it. It's a duty. At the SARB, they were specifically given the facts of this case and comments thereon.
Yes, Your Honor.
What bigger case of implied bias can you find? I mean, if you are John Doe on the street corner and you're looking at this, what are you going to think?
Your Honor, I think there are a few different answers to that question.
I'd like to hear them.
First of all, I think you need to look at the commander's role in the SARB. The commanders are not by regulation members of the SARB. They attend the SARB, and as they testified during the Article 39A session, they do so for the purpose of briefing their own unit slides. I think Colonel Ackerman, during his testimony, stated at JA 173, that only his cases have ever stood out to him. And then at JA 176, I didn't know this was the same case. No personal identification information was given. And perhaps at JA 206, Colonel Forsyth even said, I'm in listen mode in that meeting. If it's not a case that's from my brigade, I'm kind of tuned out.
But isn't it a problem that it doesn't matter if they misremembered how much they were told? I mean, it doesn't matter. They were given the facts of the case before when they were at the SAR.
Your Honor, they said
that they weren't. And they said that no in response to the question about whether they were involved in a sexual assault response sort of a thing.
Your Honor, when you look at whether or not they were honest as far as answering that question, perhaps the answers could have been answered more precisely.
No, the answer is that they were not. If you ask me, you know, did you do X or do you know X, and I did X and I know X, and I say no, that's not an honest answer. I mean, it doesn't matter if my motivation is pure, right? It's still not an honest answer.
Certainly, that is the holding in Al-Baj. It doesn't matter what your motive necessarily was, but it does matter whether or not your answer was honest or would have changed based on different questions.
Don't you think that this looks, what I'm saying is, and I asked this question at the beginning, is doesn't it look worse that they did know and they said that they didn't? I mean, if they had said, yes, I was a member of the SARB and blah, 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 right, the government could have possibly rehabilitated them, and that would have been fine. But it looks bad when they all say no when they should have said yes.
And then they discuss it when the members go out, but they don't tell the judge. I mean, this is, to put it mildly, awfully disingenuous for a bunch of senior officers who are sitting as members of a court-martial. Don't you agree?
Your Honor, well, going back to their role, first of all, their role in the SARB, they're commanders. So they attend the SARB. They don't sit on the SARB. They're not active members in the SARB. At JA 197, Colonel Forsyth described
the SARB. I'm sorry, you're not answering my question.
Certainly not. When you look at your question as it relates to implied bias, when you look at implied bias, you have to look at a member of the public familiar with the military system.
A member of the public familiar with the military system would expect, A, people to tell the truth and fully answer the judge's questions, and, B, once they all realize that they, in fact, have heard about this case before, to go tell the judge.
Certainly, Your Honor. After
the guy's been convicted.
Yes, Your Honor. And the military judge, in addressing the findings of fact, did state that while it would have been helpful for him to have come forward, even assuming that he answered questions incorrectly during voir dire, that it would not have formed a valid basis for a challenge for cause. And
do you think this is a good system, the way the system was set up, where all the commanders go to a briefing where all of the sexual assault cases on the base are discussed, and then later those same members are quite commonly called to sit on courts-martial?
Your Honor, there are a lot of important reasons to have the sexual assault.
No, that's not what I asked. I didn't ask the reasons behind it. I just asked whether or not that's a good system. Should these people be exposed to those kind of facts? And that follows what Colonel Forsythe's concern when he made his suggestions that they no longer get briefed on the facts.
There are certain reasons where it could be necessary that commanders are exposed to very minimal facts of cases, as was addressed for purposes of best practices and forming TTPs and responding.
So then they should be listening to the other people's presentations.
Yes, Your Honor, that possibly would be a way that you could change this, but that doesn't mean that right here we have an implied bias issue. You have to look at all of the answers during the 39A and assume that those are the answers that would have been given at voir dire if these questions had been asked further. And each of the commanders who answered during the Article 39A stated that they were only familiar with their slides, that they didn't otherwise listen to the other slides that were presented by other units. At JA-196, on average, 45 to 50 slides were presented during a meeting, according to Colonel Forsythe. And at JA-200, on average, a minute or less were spent on each of the slides. When you look at this in regard to a commander's overall role and all of the different duties a commander has, their job at the SARB is not anything more than to brief what's going on in their unit.
So what you're saying really is that they are dragged in there against their will, sitting there bored out of their minds, except when they're poked and told to tell their stuff, and the rest of the time they're staring off into space, and that therefore that's a legally cognizable difference.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think that that does have some bearing on whether or not they should have answered the questions about whether they knew the facts of the case, because in this situation...
Oh, because they weren't listening. They were bored. Okay, but that still leaves the question of do you participate in an organization relating to sexual assaults? And that was palpably false.
And, Your Honor, when looking at the issue presented here, and it's whether or not the military judge abused his discretion in failing to grant a mistrial, it's important to note in the motion written by the defense counsel stated, the defense counsel acknowledges that from the voir dire questions presented in the case at bar, the panel could not have known whether or not they were familiar with the individual facts of the case because the most of the voir dire questions did not include any salient, unique facts about the case. The defense counsel's position on the motion for a mistrial was that they should have come forward and answered questions differently once they realized that they maybe had heard about some of the facts of the case. It was by no means that they should have answered that one specific question differently. And in looking at that, this court should look to their holding in United States versus Lake, where the court held that a claim of unfairness dissipates if defense counsel could have reasonably discovered the grounds for his untimely challenges and examined these members on them through voir dire. Here,
what was defense counsel supposed to do that he didn't do?
Defense counsel could have easily asked whether any of...
Do you sit on the SARB as opposed to do you sit on any organization dealing with sexual assault? There's not a lot of space there.
Your Honor, again, the way the first question was framed was, are you involved in the sexual response program? And it then included different titles. And those are statutory titles.
They didn't limit it to those. They just said, such as.
Yes, Your Honor, but going back to the standard in McDonough, reasonable minds can interpret a question differently. And the defense counsel could easily have then followed up with asking whether or not they attended the SARB, especially in light of the fact that the military judge found at JA-264 that although not mandated by regulation, brigade commanders in Hawaii...
Let's get to the bottom line here. Is it the government's position that by essentially answering no to the question, have any of you been otherwise involved in the sexual response system, was an accurate answer?
Your Honor, based on the way
the
question was posed, it was an accurate answer because anybody...
It was what? Did you say accurate or inaccurate?
Your Honor.
An accurate. I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
Your Honor, it was an accurate answer based on their interpretation of the question. And as McDonough says, reasonable minds can differ as it relates to different interpretations of questions. In McDonough, the court stated, to invalidate the result of a three-week trial because of a juror's mistaken, though honest, response to a question is to insist on something closer to perfection than our judicial system can be expected to give. And then the court goes on to say that, moreover, the motives for concealing information may vary, but only those reasons that affect a juror's impartiality can truly be said to affect the fairness of a trial. And here, it was very clear, based on the Article 39A session, that none of the panel members remembered anything from being participants in that SARB, and it certainly didn't affect their impartiality. To make a decision that defense wants you to make today would be to say that, per se, somebody who attends a SARB as a commander is not even an active participant in the overall SARB by regulation would per se disqualify them from sitting on.
Aren't you arguing more of actual bias than implied bias? Aren't we concerned here about how the overall system looks to the member of the public to determine whether it's fair? And the actual bias issue is whether it was or was not fair in this case. The implied bias is the appearance.
And included in the appearance is the fact that they failed to disclose it until a week after the trial, even though they discussed it amongst themselves at the trial.
Yes, Your Honor, but in looking at the appearance, one must look at why, again, going back to what the court stated in McDonough, while you don't look at the motive necessarily as the be-all, end-all, it is important in showing their impartiality and the appearance as far as the impartiality, because here it was very clear after going through their answers at the Article 39A that none of them were familiar with the facts of the case. None of them had knowledge of the case.
Horse back in the barn, though, right? They just got done sitting through this trial, right? And now they're being brought back after the trial when it's all completed and asked, you know, how badly did you lie? Oh, not very badly at all, sir, right?
I didn't remember.
You know, it wasn't that bad. You know, and the military judge, you know, who just got done with this trial, of course, you think he's going to say, yeah, let's do the whole thing over?
Your Honor,
you're asking us to make several assumptions that don't seem particularly reasonable.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the defense counsel, my colleague, noted, the military judge's findings of fact, according to both defense and government, were not clearly erroneous. So looking at the findings of fact that were made by the military judge, it is very reasonable to find that a member of the public familiar with the military system would not find that there was anything objectively unreasonable about those members having attended a meeting where they didn't remember any piece of information other than the fact that it involved a Marine, which was part of the trial otherwise. And so therefore, as a result, based on those findings, it was reasonable to find that it would not have formed a valid basis for challenge. And in looking at an implied bias challenge, although a military judge's rulings on implied bias are reviewed under a less deferential standard than actual bias, as this court stated in United States versus Clay, where a military judge recognizes his duty to liberally grant defense challenges for cause and puts his reasoning on the record, his exercise of discretion will rarely be reversed. And here, at JA 264 through about JA 266, the military judge made very thorough findings of fact as to the circumstances in this case in support of his conclusions of law, putting on the record why he believed that this would not have formed a valid basis for a challenge for cause, and therefore he did not abuse his discretion in doing so. And in addressing the fact that he found that they would not have formed a valid basis for a challenge for cause, you have to look at whether, if that was all revealed during voir dire, that would have formed a valid basis for a challenge for cause. And in doing that, based on what they said during the Article 39A, it was reasonable to decide that they wouldn't have. Certainly, if these facts had been discussed in any other forum, this court would not find that that was so much knowledge that they couldn't sit on the court-martial. In United States versus Lake, the court found jurors need not be totally ignorant of the facts and issues involved in the case before them. In United States versus Edward, the court found that there is no basis for an implied bias challenge where the provost marshal received the initial report that the accused beat the victim to death and forwarded
the report. So, counsel, how are you defining the concept of a valid basis for challenge? What does valid mean to you?
A valid basis.
Does it mean successful? That we know, as we sit here today, that it would have been successful?
Yes, Your Honor.
Really?
Had he, yes, formed a valid basis for a challenge, as in that had we been in voir dire.
So we have to know at this court that it absolutely would have been successful for there to have been a valid basis for a challenge.
Doesn't it say a valid basis for challenge, not a valid basis for a successful challenge?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that I misinterpreted the question when you first asked it. As it relates to a valid basis for challenge, here where you have an Article 39A already on the record where the military judge has decided not to, this court should not overturn that decision. Yes, it is a valid basis for challenge, but certainly when dealing with a mistrial, this court is still confined by, and which would essentially be a new trial, RCM 1210 and Article 73, which would not lower the burden on the appellant for having the case overturned.
I just have difficulty understanding how the military judge can make an ex ante sort of determination as to what he would have done when there's now an investment of time and mental energy in the court-martial by all parties concerned.
Well, Your Honor, in most cases that don't otherwise already have an Article 39A session on the record, as was identified in McDonough and numerous other cases within the civilian courts, the remedy for an issue like this is to send it back to a hearing to determine, and in civilian courts it's generally to determine actual bias. Here in the military we are extending that to implied bias, but that would mean that a lower court judge is to make that determination, and here we do have a judge who has made that determination, and based on the findings and conclusions that judge put on the record, it's very well supported by the Article 39A session. And certainly, to say that attending a SARB as a commander where you're not actually an active participant is disqualifying would be to set a broad rule this court has never done.
I don't think anyone is suggesting that the mere fact that someone sat in a SAR means that they're automatically disqualified, that there's automatically implied bias, right? I think that the concern that I'm hearing is that in this particular case, there was several members of the court-martial panel that had knowledge that they said that they didn't have, and that they did not disclose that to the judge until after the trial. And that in the context of the military justice system where the commanders get to pick the members of the court-martial, right, that adds additional concerns.
Yes, Your Honor, and I see that I'm over time. Permission
you can respond to that.
To respond to your question. I think that while there were three members who did attend the SARB as commanders, it is important to look at the fact that not one of those three members felt that they needed to answer any questions differently. And that certainly can be considered in determining whether their answers were honest as it relates to the McDonough test, because it shows what their interpretation of the questions were that were asked. Moreover, if you look at the Article 39A session, the defense counsel did not even choose to call Lieutenant Colonel Arcari to ask any questions. It was the military judge who called Colonel Arcari, which shows that they were not at that point overly concerned at all with Lieutenant Colonel Arcari having attended the SARB, which would seem to suggest it wasn't necessarily the answers to the questions by all three. Permission to conclude?
You may briefly conclude.
As the court in McDonough noted, a litigant is entitled to a fair trial, but not a perfect one, for there are no perfect trials. Here, appellant received a fair trial. Therefore, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the defense motion for a mistrial, because the panel members answered all material questions honestly, and even if this court does find that answers were incorrect, correct answers would not have formed a valid basis for challenge.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear rebuttal.
Your Honors, my colleague just suggested that you needed to be sure that there's a valid challenge for cause before granting that challenge. I would point this court to RCF 912F1N, and it talks about how a member should not sit as a member in the interest of having the court martial free from substantial doubt as to legality, fairness, and impartiality. And that is also in the liberal grant mandate. When it talks about, the case law in front of this court that this court has says in close calls, you grant, judges are supposed to grant in the interest of ensuring that the cases are free from these bias, this perception of the bias. And also, I would like to address the claims that the defense somehow, my colleague didn't use the term forfeited, but was not interested in raising certain arguments based off of tactical decisions, but calling witnesses, in particular Colonel Carr. I would just point to the arguments that the defense counsel made during the post-trial 39 session when they talked about all the members and also the military judges' analysis when he found that there was no valid challenge for cause for one of the members, any put in parentheses, or any of the three. So this was an issue that's before the military judge. The military judge chose wrongly. And pending any more questions, I apologize. There's one other issue. We, as Judge Ryan, as you noted, we're not asking for a per se rule. We're talking about the totality of the circumstances. In this case should be found that there was implied bias. And pending any further questions from the court, we have nothing further.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.